Offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet, dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, The Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, coming to you live from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam. And I'm here to continue on our pilgrimage through this beautiful text that we refer to as the Bhagavad Gita, or the Song Divine. We are in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. We've been going through it for the past, 12 weeks or so. Today's 13th episode. This has been a fascinating journey. Even so far, we have actually, the experts in Bhagavad Gita would tell us that we are nowhere near the real crux of the Gita or the real parts which speak of what the Gita stands for. But nevertheless, we've enjoyed this journey. I can tell this for myself and of course a few people who've written to us that this has been a beautiful learning for all of us, because one thing is, as we see, these are small couplets, verses which probably have about 7 to 8 words, but each word has a philosophy behind it. Because these are words which are dropped by Krishna very casually, because Arjuna is a learned person. Arjuna is an Arya, as we went through in one of the previous episodes. So he is not uninitiated or unaware of all of these concepts. But when we are studying the Bhagavad Gita, it makes sense to go into each one of these words and try to understand them. And I think that's what we've been doing, and it's been wonderful learning in depth. I hope you'll agree with me. And of course, we always have the rich resource of Swami's discourses and Swami's Vahinis to dip into every time we want more clarity and more understanding in any of these concepts that we are learning. Before we go further in the second chapter, we've gone through about 16 shlokas in chapter 2. Before we go to 17 and the shlokas that follow after that, I'll probably give you a brief summary of what we went through last week. Last week, I had time enough only for one shloka and of course a little more of the previous shloka. So we covered only the 15th, a little bit of the 15th shloka and of course the 16th shloka in much detail. In the 15th shloka, we spoke about how Krishna says that the one whose mind is not disturbed by pain and pleasure is amritatvaya kalpate, he says. That is, that such a person is deserving of immortality. And the key words in that particular shloka were vyathayanti and dhiram. To be disturbed is vyathayanti. Krishna says one who does not get disturbed, and dhiram, one who remains firm. We discussed about being disturbed, what it means to get disturbed, and how we tend to extend the suffering when we get disturbed by something which is inherently unpleasant. I would often think of this imagery for myself, and it makes it very clear for me that imagine that our mind is like a placid lake, which has a beautiful clean surface, which is perfectly still waters. Right now our mind is like that, or when nothing is going wrong with our life, or when our life is in a very smooth phase, that's what our minds are like. It's like a placid lake. In such a lake, even if we were to drop a single small stone, the ripples that would be created by that act, you would find that it would last for a very, very long time, depending on, you know, how forcefully it has been dropped and how big the lake itself is. The ripples will take a long, long time to go and hit the edge of that pool and then come back, and it takes a long time for it to settle down, right? And forget a stone, even if the breeze creates ripples, you would find that that disturbance remains in that water surface for a long time. Eventually, our minds should become like a pool of, say, oil or any such highly viscous liquid. Yes, when we throw a stone into such a pool of viscous liquid, there will be disturbance, there will be undulation. But in no time, the ripples will go away, right? Imagine a thick pool of something like a pool of tar or pool of very thick oil. Imagine dropping a stone into that. How quickly the surface will come back to its steadiness. That is the improvement that needs to happen in our minds. That is the state Krishna is saying one must reach. Yamhina vyathayanti yete. These two, that is pain and pleasure, should not disturb you. One should reach that state. Then he spoke of dhiram as firmness. And dhiram is not merely firmness which comes out of inability, but dhiram is a firmness and focus that comes out of wisdom. Then, of course, we went on to discuss about shloka number 16, where Krishna speaks of the concepts of sat and asat, reality and unreality, or truth and untruth, and also existence and non-existence. And then in that particular shloka, very beautifully, he connects sat and asat and existence and non-existence by saying, na asato vidyate bhavo, untruth does not have an existence or beingness. Na abhavo vidyate sataha, and sat or truth does not have non-being or non-existence. And we saw how that which is unreal and untrue should not, in that sense, cause us any pain at all. It would be like crying over a piece of bad news, even after we have found out and established that that news is a rumor or a lie. And that's what Krishna says, that when you know that this is untrue, when you know that this is asat, it makes no sense to cry over it. And that's why he says it is ashochan, it is not worthy to worry about, and you continue to worry about it. And that was what he says, the difference between sat and asat. Then we also discussed how truth is non-subjective and constant in the most absolute sense, right? Because when we talk about truth, we always talk of something which is equal to everybody or common to everybody. If there are 10 people witnessing a scene, what everybody has seen is the truth. If somebody were to spin a story of their own, that's untruth, because the others have not seen that thing happen in front of them, right? So we said truth is non-subjective. And then we spoke of the constancy of truth. Even when we are trying to identify a person, we always look for something which is more constant that we can attach to that person, either a birthmark, a mole, or an appearance which is at least relatively more constant. So if we were to take these two qualities of truth, even as we understand it in our day-to-day usage, and if we were to take it to its absoluteness, which means that which is absolutely constant and that which is absolutely non-subjective, that is the ultimate truth. And that's how we saw, that is the definition which the Vedas give about sat. But after defining the truth and untruth in that manner, or reality and unreality as sat and asat, Krishna goes on to say that one who does not confuse sat to be asat and asat to be sat, one who does not get confused between one being the other, and you know that is the confusion which has led to Krishna. That is the confusion that Arjuna is in. And Krishna says that one who does not do that, one who does not get confused in that manner, is a true jnani or a wise one. But in this shloka, very beautifully, Krishna uses a name called Tattva Darshinaha for one who is wise. And we discussed about the etymological meaning of that word tattva itself. Tattva comes from the word tat, and tat, as we know, it's a simple pronoun. The pronoun which we use in English, the word we use, that. Tat is nothing but that. And we saw how the very idea behind the usage of a pronoun is that it can be used commonly for any group of, either a group of people or a group of objects. We saw that if you point out to any of the objects and say that could be a tumbler, that could be a bottle, that could be a computer, that could be a mic, and that could be a watch, whatever it is. Which means when you refer to anything as that, it means the name and form does not matter. It is common. So that which negates the name and form, which is otherwise ephemeral, which has been proved till now in the previous shloka and this one, that is what we refer to as tat in an object. And tattva is that, literally saying that thatness in any object or any person is called tattva. And Krishna says a true jnani is one who's constantly able to see that tattva in whatever he is interacting with in everyday life. And that's why he calls a jnani a tattva darshina, the one who is able to see that thatness in every object and every form in front of him, and believe that the forms are changing, the forms are asat, and that tat, or that essence alone, is what is real, right? That is what we were talking about. So that is what Krishna says. He defines what is sat, he defines what is asat, he defines what is, and he defines them using the idea of existence and non-existence. And then he goes on to say how the person who is able to negate that which is unreal, not be disturbed by that which is unreal, not be deluded by what is unreal, because that is another word which Krishna used in the earlier shlokas. He says, muhyate, one who does not, na muhyate, one who does not get deluded by these play of the asat in front of them, and is able to interact and recognize what is the truth alone, and constantly remains a dhira, a constant, a firm person, seeing that tattva in whatever he sees or whatever she sees, such a person is a true jnani. So that was the 16th shloka of the second chapter that we went through. So let's begin this week's shloka, the 17th shloka. I'll play it out for you, and then I'll give you the meaning and we'll discuss about it. As always, it is in the voice of Brother Shyam, who has recorded it for us very, very beautifully, very clearly. So we'll listen to the 17th shloka of the second chapter in his voice, and then I'll give you the meaning.
Avinashi tu tadviddhi yena sarvamidam tatam vinashamavyayasyasya nakaschit kartu marhati.
But know that to be indestructible, by which all this is pervaded, none can bring about the destruction of this immutable. So that's the meaning of the 17th shloka. I know it sounds very simple when you give a meaning like that, but as I said, each one of these words have a very, very profound idea that they try to convey, and it really would be helpful for us to do that. More than this shloka, I think the shloka which follows will be one which we'll take up in more detail. But nevertheless, this shloka is also very interesting, and we'll go through that. So Krishna has defined what is sat and defined what is asat. Now he's telling Arjuna, tat yena sarvam idam tatam, that which pervades everything here, viddhi, know or understand, avinashi tu, it is certainly unperishable. So all these forms are asat. That's what Krishna is saying. All of these forms in front of you are asat. They undergo some form of change or the other. But that which pervades all these changing forms is avinashi, or undestroyable. Right? That's what he is saying. Vinasham avyayasya asya, to bring about the destruction of this indestructible, na kaschit kartum arhati. No one, absolutely no one, is capable of doing that. Right? That's what Krishna is saying here. Vinasham avyayam asya. It is impossible for anyone to bring about this destruction. Na kaschit kartum marhasi. No one has the ability or the power to bring about that. Krishna is telling Arjuna that you think that you are a great warrior. Right? That's what Arjuna has been telling. If I fight, these people will die, and if they die, and the sin will accrue to me and all of that. So Krishna is telling Arjuna that you think that you are a great warrior, that when you fight, all these people will die, and you're crying over their death already, right? You're preempting their death and you're crying over it. But what will be destroyed is only what we have defined as asat, which anyway has no bhava or beingness. Even if it did have bhava or beingness, it was for a very, very brief time. Maybe at this point I will speak a little about something which I said I will speak about when I concluded last week's episode. Where when you say that the forms are asat, the world is asat, the created world which we are seeing, you know, the objects in front of me is asat, the idea that I am so-and-so speaking to you and you are so-and-so listening to me through the radio, all of this is asat, then why does it appear so real to us? Why is that idea that this is so real? Why do we need an avatar? Why do we need a guru? Why do we need the Vedas or the Upanishads or any scripture to come and define to us what is sat and asat? Why is it not obvious to us? And that is where Swami uses a word. He says that, you know, it is technically incorrect to dismiss all of this as asat. Swami says it is rather more precise to define it as Sat Asat. Sat Asat means that which is Asat, but it appears like Sat. That which is by nature unreal, but it appears real. And another word which is used in Vedanta for that is Mithya. That's why we always say Satya and Mithya when we refer to the Brahman and the created world, God and its creation. Mithya is defined as Sat Asat. It is unreal, but as long as you're interacting with it, it appears so very real, right? So it is not absolutely foolish of us to think that the created world is real, because it is created in a manner that it appears real, right? That's how it is. And one of the reasons, I think I made a mention about this last time also, why it appears so real to us is, one is the reference of time. When we live for a period of, say, 80, 90 or 100 years, the created world has existed for billions and billions of years. So relatively, the world appears much, much more eternal to us than our own bodies and our own minds. So it is quite natural for us to look at the created world and say that this is real. This is more real than me, at least. Right? So one is the reference of time. The other thing is that focus. You know, when we look at anything, maybe we'll come to that eventually as the Gita progresses, how the idea of I am this individual actually defines the way we look at everything. That body consciousness is what defines the way we interact with the world itself. And that makes us look at any one point at any given time. I always like to give this example and it makes it more clear to me, so I thought I'll share it with you. Imagine that in the earlier times we used to have, cinema used to be a reel, right? A reel is nothing but negatives of something like 25 still photographs put together in 1 second. I don't know if I'm making that clear. Imagine a reel of negatives, and if you were to run it through a particular light or something like that, which at the rate of 25 frames per second, right? That's precisely how we used to even encode all our things. 25 frames per second is what we do, which means if you put 25 photographs of a particular event happening in front of you, one after the other, and you make them go through this projecting light at a speed of 25 frames per second, you would actually see that moving scene. So the idea of Sat and Asat is like that. Swami would often explain this using the same analogy. The light is actually the consciousness, right? The consciousness is making all of these things appear like it is happening really in front of you. At any given point, at 1/25th of a second, what is in front of this consciousness is actually that one particular frame. Imagine our lifetime to be that one particular frame. At that moment, if I were to ask, at that moment, 1/25th of a second of a 3-hour movie, at that moment, that one frame is the movie. But is that frame alone the movie? No, it is not. The movie is this entire the entire tape of negatives that we have. But at any given moment, 1/25th of a second, if you were to take it as one moment, at any given moment, that particular frame is the movie, right? And that is how we are leading our life. At right now, I am this. This, what we define as I or aham, is this body at this particular time. But if I were to think that I am only this body, that is where all the confusion comes. So Swami says that the world, our identity, the people whom we come across, they are all Sat Asat, which means they are unreal in the fundamental sense, but for that moment they are real because we are interacting with them in that particular moment. But the moment we begin to develop that broad-mindedness, or the idea of, Swami would often say, look at the world from the perspective of God. Right? When you start distancing yourself from that individual self and you start looking at this entire creation as nothing but the movie which is going at 25 frames per second or 30 frames per second or whatever it is, you will not identify any one particular frame to be the movie alone. Right? I don't know if I'm making sense, but I think eventually this idea will keep repeating again and again and we'll be able to talk about it. But that's what Krishna is reiterating in this particular shloka too. He says that you think that you're a great warrior, you're going to kill all of these people, But understand that what you will be destroying is only the asat aspect which is in front of you, and that was anyway going to perish, right? So Krishna is telling Arjuna, you think that you're a great warrior, but don't think that you're great enough to bring about the destruction of the asat. If you remove what we defined last time as the sat vastu, or that thing which is actually true in any object, the asat also vanishes, right? We spoke of the sat being the clay and asat being the pot. That is an analogy which Adi Shankara gives repeatedly in his commentaries. The moment you remove the clay, the pot does not exist. But you can break the pot and you can stop the existence of the pot, but the clay will continue to exist. So if you remove the sat vastu, the asat also vanishes. But when the asat alone is destroyed, the sat continues to exist. So when you destroy the pot, the clay remains. You can make a million pots and break it a million times. The sat vastu, or the clay, will remain. So first Krishna explained to Arjuna what is sat and asat. Then he talks about the relationship between sat and asat. And then tells him, when you see a person standing before you, like all of these elders who are in front of you, why do they matter to you? Right? If they were all corpses already, if Bhishma was already dead, or if Dronacharya was already dead, what is in front of you would have been a corpse. You would not, you know, that kind of love and affection and that all of that will not be there, right? Even if it is there, it is actually probably a memory of the past. But for that body, the love and respect that you give will be very limited, because now it is only a corpse, right? Because only when they are alive, they really matter in that sense. What makes them alive? The dehi is what makes the deha alive. So in that sense, all the respect, love and anger that we are directing towards a person is actually directed towards the dehi who is clothed in this deha or the body. So nothing that you do will ever destroy that dehi. So why all this fuss is what Krishna is asking Arjuna. That in whatever you do, you're not going to be able to destroy what is real. What is going to be destroyed is unreal, which is anyway going to be destroyed. And I think that is the theme which he's going to continue with even in the next verse. So we'll go to that, the 18th verse, and we'll discuss a little more about what we spoke of for the 17th verse when we're talking about the 18th verse.
Antavanta ime deha nityasyokta sharirinaha anashino prameyasya tasmat yudhyasva bharata.
The material bodies which this eternal, indestructible, unknowable spirit inhabits are all finite. Therefore, fight, O Bharata. There is so much of philosophical discussion which has been going on that we may eventually forget the very purpose of all this discussion. So Krishna drops a reminder that all this explanation is so that you pick up your Gandiva and fight. Of course, we'll come to that part in a bit, but as we did in some of the earlier verses, let us focus a little more on some of these words which Krishna is using to explain things to Arjuna. Antavanta ime deha. He says, antavanta ime deha. All these bodies are perishable. Nityasya uktaha sharirinaha. The indweller is said to be eternal. For the word indweller, earlier Krishna had used the word dehi, right? The one who resides in the deha or the body is the dehi, the indweller. Another word for body in Sanskrit is sharira. So here Krishna uses the word sharirin, the indweller, right? So there he used dehi, here he uses the word sharirin. And when we were going through the 1990 Samako series as part of a Shravanam Mananam series, we came across this beautiful description that Swami gives. It's a reminder from Swami about what these words deha and sharira actually mean. Swami had explained in one of those discourses, dahyate iti deha, that which burns is the deha. And in that discourse, Swami had explained that it's not just that the body is burnt after the person dies. Yes, that is done. But even as we live, the body is actually burning away. And Swami explained, worry burns away the body. Passion, anger, and all such intense emotions slowly burn the body even as we are alive. And just that, once we become lifeless or the dehi leaves the deha, people no more have the patience to see that process of decay happen right in front of them, right? So they either quickly burn you away, burn the body away, it's not you, burn the body away, or they bury it under the ground so that the decay process happens at its own pace but does not happen in front of their eyes, right? So Swami says aging, the process of going through emotions, the process of going through life itself actually decomposes the body even as we are alive. But what we refer to as the prarabdha, or what we call destiny, is what makes the dehi stick to a particular body till a certain point in time, right? And when the prarabdha towards that body is completed, then the dehi leaves, and that process of decay or decomposition happens so very quickly, right? That's what we refer to as death and decay of the body. And that is why Krishna says the transformation called aging and the transformation called death are one and the same. You think of them as different and get paranoid, right? But they are actually the same. Of course, I'm not saying that we should all start getting paranoid about aging also, the way we get paranoid about death. But the wise one will not be worried about the process of death, just as he or she is not worried about the process of aging. The other name for body is sharira, right? And this word also comes from a very, very similar idea. And Swami says, sharayati iti sharira. That which decays is the sharira. That which burns is the body. That which decays is the body. Sharayati iti sharira. As we just saw, which only decays after death. Body is not that which only decays after death. But the process of aging itself is a form of decay. In one of the afternoon satsangs, I think quite recently, Arvind had made a mention of this, how many of the scientists are now coming to believe that the process of actually breathing in oxygen, even as we are alive, also causes decay to the body. And it makes a little bit of sense, because Swami would often say that, you know, in yoga, in the practice of yoga, so much of emphasis is laid on the process of breathing. And in that context, Swami would say, some of these animals like dogs that breathe in and breathe out much, much faster, or many, many more times in a minute compared to, say, the human beings, they tend to lead much shorter lifespans, right? And those other animals and reptiles, we tend to breathe much, much more slowly. They lead lives way longer than even human beings can. So it makes sense that probably this process of breathing in, the oxygen which actually keeps us alive, is also responsible for this decay, right? The point is, what we refer to as life, which is breathing, is also playing a key role in the decay of the body. And that is why Krishna said the transformation from kaumaram, yavanam, manjara, boyhood, youth and old age, is similar to the decay that happens to the body at death. And in this particular verse, Krishna reiterates that by saying, antavantam ime deha, all these bodies are perishable. All these bodies will perish anyway. And that is why they are called deha, they are called sharira. And they are called sharira because to decay is their destiny. To decay is the very destiny, or the prarabdha of the body, if you could put it that way. How profoundly intertwined, if you come to think of it, is the philosophy of Bharat, or the Vedanta philosophy, with the language Sanskrit, right? The body is given a name that the name itself suggests that the body is perishable. It's called deha because it gets burnt, and it's called sharira because it decays. But that which lives on, the dehi, it's given the name jiva. Jiva means that which lives, right? So beautiful. Deha is that which burns and sharira is that which decays. But jiva is that which lives. The dehi is called jiva. The indweller is the one who is actually alive. Coming back to this particular verse, there is another subtle hint that Krishna drops here. When he refers to the body, Krishna uses the plural. He says, Dehaha. Right? He uses the plural. But when he is talking about the indweller of the bodies, he uses singular. He says, Sharirinaha. Because this concept that there are many bodies, but there's only one indweller is something which Krishna will come to and explain in detail later. But he's for now dropping a very beautiful hint. He's saying that there are many bodies, but the indweller is only one. Apart from all of these, there are a couple of other interesting things about this particular shloka. Krishna uses three adjectives to describe the sharirinaha or the indweller. Krishna says, anashinaha, it cannot be destroyed or is not subject to destruction. Nityaha, it is eternal. And lastly, he says, aprameya, that which cannot be known. We'll come to the aspect of aprameya in a bit, but let's talk about the first two adjectives of nityaha and anashinaha. These two words actually have a very, very similar meaning. They almost appear like the same, synonyms of the same word. Why then is Krishna using both of these words in the same shloka? Adi Shankara very, very beautifully and succinctly explains this, these two words and the difference between these two words and the different qualities that they denote in his commentary of this particular verse. Let's say that there is a pot. So we are constantly going back to the pot because, if you look at it, the times of Adi Shankara, that probably would have been the most easy thing to explain things with. Right, you didn't have the more sophisticated product that we have in today's world. It was always easy to take the example of a pot. Let's say that you have a pot here. There is a crack in the pot. Or I do something, I drop the pot or I bang it against the wall and there is a crack in the pot. The moment there is a crack in the pot can no more be used to store water. Right? That's simple logic. That means the utility of that particular object as a pot has been destroyed. Though the broken pot will continue to exist, will continue to remain. I hope you're understanding the drift of what Shankara explains so beautifully here. You have a pot. The idea of the pot can be destroyed in the sense that the moment there's a hole or there's a crack, you cannot use the pot anymore. But the broken pot will continue. Or even if you say that you break that pot into 10 or 20 pieces, the broken pot will continue to exist, but the pot, the utility of the pot has been destroyed, right? That means the utility of that object has been destroyed, though the broken pot or the broken object continues to exist. If you look at it, the way we are all misusing the natural resources in the world today, if we don't take corrective action, I think this is something which has been told to us again and again, something similar will happen to Mother Earth too. The Earth will continue to exist, but we would have destroyed it, right? That's precisely what is happening now. And that's what, that is the idea it is. You can destroy an object and the destroyed object can continue to exist. I can have a phone, I can have a broken phone. The moment I drop it and I break the screen or I mess up with the motherboard or whatever happens into that phone, I can no more use that phone. That phone is not a phone to me anymore. But that object can continue to exist in my house, right? So in the same manner, these two things are very distinct qualities of the Atma. Yes, the Atma is eternal, so it is called Nityaha. Nityaha means eternal, but it also cannot undergo any change. It is eternal as it is. That is why it is the essence, the tattva, or the ultimate sat, because it cannot be broken down or it cannot be, it is immutable in that sense, right? If you actually go back to the medieval sciences, you know, when the scientists first named the atom as the atom, the logic was that, you know, they said that here is the smallest part of matter, the smallest piece of matter. All matter that we see is made up of this particular building block in different combinations, right? That's what they came up with. And that is the idea behind naming that particular entity as an atom. Atom comes from the Greek word atomos, which means it cannot be broken any further. Of course, the idea has changed because now we have found all of these electrons, protons, neutrons, and subatomic particles and all of that. But earlier when it was named the atom, that was the idea that this cannot be broken down any further. The Atma, which sounds very strikingly similar to the word atom, also follows a very similar meaning. This cannot be further broken down. That is why another name for Atma is Akshara, that which cannot be broken down or destroyed to make smaller parts any further. Coming back to the description of the Sharirinaha in this particular verse, or the indweller, that is precisely why Krishna uses two similar words, Nityaha and Anashinaha. It is eternal in the sense that it never ceases to exist because it does not have abhava, as he explained in a couple of verses back. Na bhavo vidyate sataha. Krishna told in the previous verse or a couple of verses before this. But it is also indestructible in the sense that no change can occur to its nature. The body lives for 100 years, but infancy is destroyed for the childhood to begin. Childhood melts away for the youth to come in. And similarly, old age destroys youth. Even this type of gentle destruction, if we could call it that, does not occur to the indweller or the Sharirinaha. And that is why Krishna uses two words, even though they appear similar, these are the ideas that they convey, that it is eternal, but it also remains as it is. It does not undergo any form of change. Excuse me. The other adjective that Krishna uses in this particular verse is aprameya. I think we've spoken about this name extensively, at least on my other shows. I've made a mention about this. Now, this word aprameya, it's actually a name which is used to describe God himself. In fact, it is one of the names in the Vishnu Sahasranamam. And interestingly, it is mentioned along with another name that you know, we've come across many, many times in the Bhagavad Gita already. In the Vishnu Sahasranamam, it appears as Aprameyo Rishikesha. The name Rishikesha, which is used for Krishna, we have come across multiple times. And he also used the word Aprameya. Now, what is the meaning of this word Aprameya? The word comes from another word which is called Pramana. A Pramana is a means of knowledge or a means of understanding something. The simplest means of understanding anything is through our own senses, right? What we can observe directly. What is happening right in front of me, I've seen it with my own eyes, I've heard it with my own ears, and I've experienced it myself, right? It's directly available to my senses. So such a means of knowing something is called pratyaksha pramana. Let's say something cannot be understood directly. Suppose I have seen it myself, but you have not seen it. I'm trying to explain it to you. And I explain it to you based on something that you have already seen or you already know. So I will use the techniques of extrapolations and comparisons, right? That is called upamana pramana. Anumana is through inferences. Let's say we are, you know, waiting outside our boss's cabin to go into his cabin and meet him. We have not yet seen the boss on that particular day, but based on the expression of the person who's coming out of the boss's cabin, we will be able to understand what is the mood of the boss, right? If he comes in with a bad face, we know that the boss's mood is very bad, right? It's how is it that we have not seen it ourselves, we have not heard it from anybody else, we have not got any proof of it, but just by seeing the scenario around, we are able to guess that, right? That is what we refer to as anumana pramana. Another form of knowing is knowing through someone else. Somebody else has seen, but he comes and tells, he or she is somebody whose words we trust, whose words we accept. And so whatever description is given, we accept it. That's called Shabda Pramana. And invariably, Shabda Pramana is more given to the scriptures, right? Accepting the words of scriptures as the ultimate and trying to understand things better. So now the Dehi is referred to as Aprameya. So the knowledge about everything, every event, every concept in the world we live in, can be understood through one or a combination of what we defined as pramanas or means of knowledge, right? Of course, I don't have the time to give examples for each one of them. And it's actually a very scientific concept. This particular idea of pramanas and different kinds of pramanas, a very, very scientific approach to try to understand the reality of Earth, which Vedanta uses. But we'll go back to the verse where now the Dehi is being referred to as aprameya. So what is this word aprameya? As the name itself suggests, that which is beyond the pramanas, that which cannot be understood or explained through the pramanas, right? When we refer to something as aprameya, it means that you cannot see it yourself, you cannot be understood through your mind, right? Example I always like to give is when we say a particular organism is invisible to the naked eye, is a description we often come across in science, which means however much I try with the naked eye, I cannot see, because that is the quality of the organism. We often use something called a dog whistle, right? The dog whistle emits a sound which is in decibels that the human ear cannot pick up, right? So however keenly I may try to hear, I could maintain pin drop silence, I could ensure that everybody is quiet around, but still I cannot listen to that dog whistle, because by nature it emits sound which the human ear cannot pick up, right? Because the feature of that particular sound or of that particular sight by nature is not accessible to my senses, they are beyond my senses. Similarly, we have these different means of knowing something, the pramanas, but this soul, this dehi, is beyond all these means of knowledge. You can stand upside down, you can fast, you can meditate, you can do whatever you want, but you will not be able to understand the indweller. That's what it means. And that's why in the Taittiriya Upanishad it says, yato vacho nivartante aprapya manasasaha, failing to reach which words turn back along with the mind. Right? That's how it is described, the Brahman and the indweller. So if the self cannot be known by any pramana, why the scriptures, why these satsangs and why these discourses? It after all cannot be understood through the mind, right? Even shabda pramana or explanation from an expert or reading it from Upanishads is not going to help. Then how can all of these things enable us to see something like the dehi or understand something like the Brahman? Maybe we'll save this particular discussion for later, because Krishna will eventually explain this, how even though it is aprameya, it is not understood through the human mind or through words, you can, through the process of sadhana, make yourself available to that tattva-darsha, the ability to see that truth. There's another word in this particular shloka that is very interesting. Antavanta ime deha nityasya uktaha sharirinaha. Krishna uses the word uktaha, which means it is said so. That's the meaning of the word uktaha. It is said that the indweller of this perishable body is eternal, Krishna says. This is important though it's very, very subtle. Krishna is speaking very, very forcefully and commandingly, right? All this while we've been noticing that. But still Krishna is saying that it is said so. Why is he saying that? Meaning when he says that it is said that this dehi is eternal, it is said that this dehi is imperishable, it is said that this dehi is cannot be destroyed by any human action. Krishna is making references to the Vedas, the Upanishads, right? He's making references to what we called as Shruti. And as I had explained in the curtain raiser episode, the Gita is a Shruti as well as a Smriti. Shruti is that which has not been created by human activity, right? That which has been heard, it's said to be a divine gift. The Vedas are Shruti, the Upanishads are Shrutis. But Smriti is something which has been created by man, and one of the features of Smriti is it constantly makes references to the Shruti. It says, this is what this particular Upanishad says, or as it is explained in this particular Veda, right? So a Smriti is created by an individual, but constant references to the Shruti are inherent part of a Smriti, right? So still Krishna is actually in that sense, in what we could probably define as the Smriti mode. He's still making references to the Gita and, references to the Shrutis or the Vedas. He can, of course, authoritatively say that this is what it is, right? Because, constantly saying Bhagwan Vacha, Bhagwan Vacha, the Lord himself is speaking. He can say that this is how it is, Arjuna, but he's still making references to the Shruti, which means literally he's brushing up Arjuna's learning from his school days. Maybe he's saying that you've heard all of this. You know, I'm merely making references to all of that and I'm trying to explain these things to you. So in that sense, Krishna is still in the Smriti mode, but as we go through the Bhagavad Gita, we will realize that his explanations become more and more authoritative when he says that this is what it is. Understand this to be the ultimate truth. And eventually he'll of course say that it is me who spoke this truth to so-and-so and eventually it has come to you. Right? So that's another beautiful hint about this word being used there, uktaha, which means Krishna is saying that it is said that all of this is imperishable and this is perishable. After all these extensive explanations, how does Krishna conclude this particular verse? He says, tasmat yuddhasva bharata. Therefore, Arjuna, fight. It is not to say that, you know, if you look at it, if you go through all of these verses that we've gone through, it is like saying, look, Arjuna, anyway, everything is going to get destroyed. Anyway, everybody is going to die. You know, you might as well go and have some fun being a warrior, right? That is not what Krishna is suggesting here when he says yuddhasva, which means fight. Krishna is not telling Arjuna that anyway, all of these people will die. So you don't worry about killing them. If not you killing them, some other person will kill them. So you might as well enjoy. That's not the idea which Krishna is suggesting here. You know, when I was a kid, I remember seeing a small play in Hindi where in this particular play, it's a middle class family. It's a small family with, you know, a mother, father and probably two children, where there is this particular boy who's probably going to high school or is going to college or something like that. He gets fascinated about one particular brand of shoe, which is extremely expensive. Many of his friends have bought it and it's clearly beyond the means of this particular family to spend so much on one particular sports shoe, right? But for some reason, you know, it happens to most of us during teenage, he gets a fascination for this and he starts asking his parents, no, you do something, you please get me this shoe. So, and typically like how most parents do, they start putting conditions, right? You have to get this much marks in this particular paper. You have to do this particular work in the house. Then all of these things you do, then we'll see. We'll get you that. So this boy is so obsessed with that shoe. So he does all that he can do to ensure that, you know, he pleases his parents. And finally, his parents say that, no, we have to do it for him because he's done all that we've asked him to do. So they get him this particular shoe. It's extremely expensive. I don't remember what was the price which was said then. Now it might sound very a very small amount. So when they finally get him the shoe looks so very exclusive and so something beyond what he has ever used that this boy actually refuses to use the shoe. He says, no, I cannot use this because it's so expensive. So eventually what does he do? He actually carries the shoe around and when he goes to bed, he's actually hugging the shoe and sleeping. And you know, his parents are trying to convince him to use the shoe, but he says, no, I cannot use the shoe because it's so good. So the description, I mean, what they tell the boy is that. They say that, look, this is actually a shoe which has been created from raw material like this. Whether you use it or not, the shoe is actually going to get old, right? Yes, by you using it, the shoe is going to get old faster. It's going to get dirty faster. But nevertheless, if you were to keep it in the corner, and Swami would often say that, you know, when Swami is giving these safari clothes or these material to be stitched into clothes, Swami would say that. So you keep it in the cupboard. After 20 years, you take it out and then you stitch it and you wear. The shirt and pant is new, but the cloth is old. So in no time, you would find that even though it's a new pair that has been stitched, it tears away because the form is new, but the material is old, right? And similarly, that's what will happen to even a shoe. If you don't use it and you keep it, the shoe still keeps aging, right? So eventually the shoe will get spoiled. So that's what the parents tell him. They tell him that, see, the shoe is meant to get destroyed by using, the shoe is meant to eventually get worn out, the shoe is meant to get dirty, because that's the whole idea of a shoe. You use it to be worn on the feet, which actually it becomes dirty instead of you becoming dirty, right? That's the whole idea of a shoe or a footwear. So they tell him all of this and they say that, you know, you should use it, you might as well use it and, you know, let it perish in that manner rather than you doing all of this and not using the shoe. So the reason why I was reminded of that is this is very, very similar to what Krishna is telling Arjuna here. After explaining the inevitability of the destruction and decay of the body, he's telling Arjuna, see, you might as well do what you are supposed to do, right? Of course, the added input Krishna is giving here is about the Dehi, but precisely what the parents were telling that son, that see, this is what is meant to be done with the shoe. This is how you're meant to, you know, you have to do what you have to do. Don't worry about the shoe being dirty or shoe getting destroyed, however expensive it is. That has to happen, right? So the same thing Krishna is telling, that however great the person is in front of you, he could be the great Bhishma, he could be the great Drona, unrivaled in his ability to teach the form of archery, however great that person may be, eventually all of these people are going to die. They're all perishable. They're all have a limited existence. He's not saying that you can go and kill them. He's saying that you might as well do what you have to do, right? But Arjuna, being a kshatriya, being a warrior, being at that point in the battlefield ready for warfare, to fight is what he has to do. And that's why Krishna says, Yuddhasva Bharata. He says, you might as well do what you have to do. It is not that, you know, anyway they're dying, you can kill them anyway. It's not that. Anyway, this is eventual. Eventually it is going to happen. But being in this position, this being your duty, you might as well do what you are meant to do. And I think this is, in a sense, is a tip for all of us, right? If we wish to overcome sorrow in day-to-day life, what must we do? We must contemplate on this idea of what is perishable as well as what is imperishable, right? That is why Krishna adds that added discussion about the Dehi being imperishable too. You might as well just stop by saying that the bodies are perishable. He also talks about the Dehi. He also talks about the soul being constant, because one of the best ways to come over sorrow of any form in our life, be it a small sorrow or intense sorrow in the case of Arjuna like this, is to constantly contemplate on what is eternal and what is ephemeral, right? That is why Swami would often say, smara nitya anityatam. That is one of the very, very effective and very important sadhana that we all have to do. Constantly see what is nitya and what is anitya. Smara nitya anityatam. And just again to give the meaning of this particular verse, because we must have got lost in all of this, Krishna says in this particular verse, which is the 18th, he says, the bodies which this spirit, which is said to be eternal, indestructible, unknowable, inhabits, are all perishable. Therefore, fight, O Bharata. He says, the bodies which this spirit, the spirit is of course eternal, indestructible, unknowable, but it inhabits the perishable body. So, O Arjuna, take your Gandiva and fight. I think we'll have a little bit of time to probably listen to verse number 19. Maybe might not have time to go into the detail, but as much as time permits, we'll just go through that before we conclude today's program.
Ya enam veti hantaram yaschainam manyate hatam ubhau tau na vijanito nayam hanti na hanyate.
He who thinks of this one as the killer and he who thinks of this one as the killed, both of them do not know. This one does not kill, nor is it killed. That's the meaning of verse number 19. And in this particular verse, Krishna introduces the two very important concepts of doership and enjoyership. because I'm saying enjoyership, but it is actually being the doer of a pleasant or an unpleasant act, being doership, and being the recipient of a pleasant or unpleasant act as being referred to as enjoyership. Kartritva and bhoktritva. These are the two words which are used in Sanskrit. That's why we are, in English, we are using the word enjoyership, but it's not literally in that sense of enjoying something. Yet, in the context of this war, when Arjuna acts, there is going to be killing, right? So Krishna makes the reference to the act of killing in this particular shloka, but the concept, the basic concept is that of kartritva and bhoktritva, but he uses the word killing. He says, ya enam veti hantaram, the one who thinks so-and-so is the killer, yacha enam manyate hatam, and the one who thinks so-and-so has been killed, ubhav tauna vijani tho, both of them don't know, or both of them are not knowledgeable. That's what Krishna says. The one who thinks that so-and-so is killed, and the one who thinks that so-and-so is the killer, both of them are actually not knowledgeable in that sense. Na ayam hanti na hanyate. This neither kills nor gets killed. And this, when he says, he is referring to the Atma. Na ayam hanyate na hanyate. Na hanti na hanyate. It neither kills nor can it be killed. So Krishna is saying the truly wise will identify themselves with the Atma, and the Atma does not act nor can it be subject to others' action. So this is a very, very important point about the balance of approach that is needed, right? That we neither are the ones who do nor are we the ones who are subject to somebody else's act. Probably I'll quickly conclude with one particularly interesting conversation that I happened to have with the doctor, and maybe we'll take it on from there. I had done one particular program which was basically an answer to a question. The question was, what happens to a person after death? So if you're interested, of course, you can look up that question as part of the answering booth, where I'd compiled whatever Swami says based and whatever the scriptures say about what happens to the body. The sukshma sharira withdraws from the stula sharira and all of that. So this particular doctor was telling me, was having this interesting discussion with him. He asked me about the case of patient being brain dead, right? That's something which they come across quite often. So when the patient becomes brain dead, what do? They put that person on a ventilator, right? So essentially the person is kept alive because that person is connected to all of these machines which do the process of breathing for him. So he was saying that, see, you are telling me that how does death happen? The death happens when the sukshma sharira withdraws from the stula sharira. But in a case of a patient like this, as a doctor, the day I switch off the ventilator, the person dies, right? So isn't it my action which is causing the death? Where is the question of the sukshma sharira or the mind of the person withdrawing from the body? And, when he said this, I was thinking that this is precisely what Arjuna asks Krishna, right? Because Arjuna was asking that, look, I'm going to fight. The moment I start firing arrows, people are going to die. So which means he was saying that death is in his hands, and that was the very idea which Krishna was removing, that death and birth happens because of a much larger scheme of things. So even though you're a warrior and it looks like your actions are resulting in death, it's not so. So you just be an instrument there, and you're supposed to just do best what you can do, right? That's the essence of the Bhagavad Gita. So I was telling this person that this is what Krishna was explaining to Arjuna. So as a doctor, I think the approach that a doctor must have is, be firmly rooted in the belief that when he heals a patient, when he cures a patient, be firm in the belief that I am not curing this person. The cure is happening because of God, and I'm just being instrumental here. So if one is established in that idea, I think even when, because of your act, like in the case of you switching off a ventilator, even when death happens as a result of your act, you can firmly say that, you know, that person's prarabdha ended, or that person had to die, or Swami decided that person's end has come. I was only instrumental there. So this was what I was telling him, and he told me that, you know, all of this works in the Dwapara Yuga and the previous in the previous ages where people were very pure. It doesn't work in the present times. And he gave an example of how there was this one particular patient who had come in for a surgery, and he was, I think, an anesthesiologist or some anesthetist or anesthesiologist, something which Swami would always play with these two words. Whatever it is, he was supposed to put that person under, make that person unconscious for a particular surgery. And oftentimes they say that it's one of the most trickiest parts in a surgery, because when you put down a patient, you actually lose a lot of control over that patient, and you might lose that patient. And that's precisely what happened. That patient died on the operation theater when this person had given anesthesia to that particular lady. And he was saying that how it became a legal complication. The people took it to court and they kind of sued him for it. And of course, Swami's grace, nothing. He came out of that case without any problems. But he was saying that, see, this is how people are. So I was thinking, see, this is what Krishna is telling here. You neither think that you are the doer, nor do you think that you're subject to others' actions. If as a doctor, I'm carrying out my profession by thinking that the healing happens, death also happens, and I'm just instrumental there, it doesn't happen because of me. Which means I'm, as Krishna was explaining, I'm thinking that I'm not this body, I'm only the Dehi, right? Similarly, when you get into a case like this, or somebody sues you for, tries to blame you, I think that also is a moment for you to think that the action of that person is directed towards the Deha and not towards me. To be detached even through that process is what is the balance which Krishna is referring to. Because that is Bhoktaratva, right? When you give up Bhoktaratva, you feel that yes, you are suing this individual, you are suing this person, but I have nothing to do with that, right? So that's what Krishna is trying to explain to Arjuna, that you act without feeling that your act is what is responsible for what is happening. And you also act with a feeling that whatever others may do, it actually happens only to the body and it does not happen to me. That's why he says, the one who thinks that so-and-so is killed and the one who thinks that so-and-so is the killer, both of them are deluded. So dear listeners, we'll conclude with that. We'll continue with this. Do join me again next week, 7:30 p.m. for resuming this Triune Pilgrimage of the Gita series. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the last segment of today, the Vahini Satsang. I'll meet you all next week, 7:30 p.m. in the next episode of the Gita series.